Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you for that kind introduction. What I want to try and do tonight is just set the scene, not just for this course, but for the thinking about enterprise, because enterprise is the word I would choose to use to characterise what we want to talk about. It's not entrepreneurship. It's not sort of being an entrepreneur in quite the way that most people think of it. It's the process of enterprise, and there are things that you need to be aware of. Now, if I can get this to work. Hang on. There we go. So let's start with what is a business, the first thing that we want to talk about. Well, it is very simple. A business is an entity, typically a company, which is, you should think of like a human being. It has rights, including, for example, the right to own property, such as intellectual property, and more of that later. But basically, it's something that sells one of two things. And I can't think of anything else that you can sell other than a product or a service. That's it. Now, smart companies sell both, but that's it. And the key thing about running a business is that you have to do this and make a profit. Now, I'm professionally indifferent as to what you spend that profit on. If you want to spend it on cocktails in the Bahamas, then try Johnny Canoes. If you want to give it to a charity, then we've set one up to support disabled entrepreneurs. You can give me a check as you leave. I don't mind. But you have to make a profit. So I'm not a fan of the idea of not-for-profit organisations. Such things really don't exist. Not for distribution is a different matter, where you may reinvest profits for some social good, and very, very keen that you may be thinking about those, that would be great. But you have to make a profit, so it's about selling things. So it's about the mindset of selling. And all of you in the room who are students are already investors. You've invested in your education in terms of course fees, in terms of time, and so forth. So you've got to think about how will you get a return on that investment. So I'd counsel anybody in academia to be thinking in a more enterprising way. But you've got to be ultimately focusing on what are you going to sell? It is that crude. What are you going to sell? What is going to be your product or your service? Okay? Now, I think that it's very easy to start a business as long as you've got something to sell. But even that isn't critical. Of the three spin-outs that I did from this university, we didn't have anything to sell to begin with. We had the promise of drug development and opportunities further down the line, maybe in 8 or 10 years' time. But at the outset, there was nothing to sell. But that didn't dissuade investors from putting money into the opportunity. But ultimately, it had to be clear that there was an end product or service that would be sold. And that's terribly important if you're thinking of raising money from investors. So terribly important then to think about funding right from the outset. Why? Because most businesses are underfunded from the start. Most businesses are underfunded from the start. So startup funding is actually critical. So you need the idea of what you're going to sell, you need some cash, and you need a team of people. Now I've said here owners and doers. There are those people who may own the business. And perhaps, for example, if it was a spin-out from this university, the university may have a number of shares in that business quite properly. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing any work. They're not the doers. So don't confuse ownership with activity. Activity is by the sort of worker bees. Similarly, I think it's really important to recognise that you can have both ownership and activity. And more of that in a moment about how you get your return. But part of the team is a range of professional advisors that you will need. You're going to have people in your team to do the operational stuff, but you will need a full range of professional advisors, accountants, lawyers, human resources specialists, and so forth. And so you've got to think from the outset about not being in isolation, but being as part of a team and thinking about how you're going to build that team. Terribly important. So from your perspective, kind of what's in it for you. Now, I've heard that some people work 9 to 5, 5 days a week for the same employer. I know it's hard to believe, but I've heard it's true. I've also heard that such people, no matter how successful their employer is and that business is, they still take home the same amount of money each month. I know it's shocking, but believe me, it's true. And further, I've also heard that those people sign something called a contract of employment, that says that if for some reason the employer doesn't want to employ them anymore, they tell them a month in advance and they're gone. So I can't quite get this concept of security by being an employee. A lot of people say the things that you just do, Russ, are terribly risky. This kind of enterprise and businesses, it's all very risky, you know, and they're on a month's notice. So I'm lucky, I work for several different things. And so if one of them goes down, then the others will step in or will start another business. So it's a different sort of mindset to encourage you to think about. And I think there are three sources of revenue that I'd encourage you to consider. Now, a salary from employment, that's okay, take the money, but it's not the only source. What I'm also wanting you to think about is profit sharing. Now, some people in sales organisations, I don't know, double glazing salesperson, will perhaps have at the end of the month a bonus dependent upon the amount of double glazing they've sold that month. And so they're sharing in something of the profit. And that sounds okay, except that employers tend to give them a reduced salary and expect them to build that up to what they need by this commission. So it's supposed to motivate them. So there are other ways in which you can benefit from profit sharing, however, and that is going to be in terms of shares in the business or a share option system. And we'll come back to that later, how you can participate in that. And then finally, a capital gain. If you are earning, I forget the numbers exactly, but over 150,000 per year, so if you're a high-paid person, you're going to be paying 50% income tax, you're going to be paying national insurance, so you're only probably taking home about 40% of what you're earning. Whereas if you make a capital gain through the sale of the business, you'll pay a lot less tax in capital gains tax. So you have to recognise that perhaps you should put together in terms of your career and your aspirations a portfolio. Often people say, I'd like to start a business. And my answer to that is, great, but why only one? You know, so you mustn't just think about putting all the eggs in one basket. No matter how much of a risk taker you are, and I don't think that enterprising people, by the way, are risk takers. Risk takers you see in the pub standing by the slot machine feeding £1 coins in. Those are risk takers. But they're certainly not risk averse, but I think they are something different, what I would call a risk reader. Partly, they quite enjoy the challenge of a problem that somebody said couldn't be done, and finding a novel way of achieving a solution. I think enterprising people kind of like that, actually. But equally, I think they are risk readers, and they can determine what the likely risk of failure is and success. And they do their darndest to remove as much risk as possible. And that's why they can pitch successfully to investors or persuade the bank manager that she should make them a loan. So I think risk readers. And if you're starting to think about the risk components in how you will put together your own personal portfolio of your revenue generation, be you a lecturer, head of department, researcher with patents, or simply a student in the early phase of your career, it doesn't matter. I think you've got to be thinking in an enterprising way about how to balance the various sources of revenue. And many people from universities who say, well, I'm a university lecturer, you know, I'm very content as an academic and I'm happy having one job. Now, this is the person who runs a team of PhD students, this is the person who is raising money maybe from some research council to support their department. They will have lecturing responsibilities, departmental duties, they'll do a bit of consulting for private companies. They probably have seven jobs before you start, you know, to think too deeply. So actually, quite often people have several jobs without really realising it. So it's not anything new to do that. It's a case of trying to balance that portfolio. So I think you should stop thinking like employees. You have this idea that you work for one person and you have one source of revenue. And think a little bit more like an employer. And certainly what you've got to recognise with respect to companies, if you are to start a company, then you can start a company to generate profit and you can use that profit to put food on the table, that's fine. But it tends to be quite a slow process to do that. And so you may need to borrow money to make it go faster, or you may need to get investment to make it go faster. Because really, with business, what you want to do is to build it up and sell it, and then do the next one, and then do the next two, and then do the next seven, or whatever. So it's a different mindset about not necessarily building a business to give you a job for life. It's about building a business to put it out there for sale and then to take a capital gain. So, I've mentioned it is very easy to start a business. Unfortunately, too easy, because the statistics are pretty bad. You know, the number of businesses registering and deregistering for VAT every year is broadly the same, but within 3 years, typically, around half of businesses fail. You know, that's just not good enough. It is not good enough. So there are lots of enterprising people. There are lots of people who want to run their own business. A recent survey from the government said about 1 in 11 people wanted to quit their job. Now, that may be because they hate their current boss, or it could be because they want to start a business, and that's what they said. Nevertheless, you know, it's popular. It's never more popular than in the current climate. So I think the challenge here is not starting a business. The challenge is about making a business sustainable. Okay, so that's the first key thing you have to recognise is, how do I make this business sustainable? So is that easy? No, it's very, very hard. It's very, very hard indeed. It needs the funding at the outset, as I've mentioned. It needs a great deal of determination and stamina to actually make it work. Some days, you know, often people in business say they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. My experience is it's rather more than that sometimes. So you've really got to recognise it's going to be tough. But equally, you probably don't need to work, when you've got it going, 5 days a week or whatever. You can work with other things, but it is very tough. So don't let me try and suggest that it's easy. It's easy to start the business, but it's tough to make it sustainable and really, really, really difficult to make it successful. Now, I think you've got to have an understanding of the people that you will need around you to make this successful. That's the first thing. And so you need to be thinking about a business plan and putting all of those ideas together. And you really should get as much help and support as you can find. So this group, by definition, is already off to a flying start by enrolling for this course. So get whatever help you can. Now, of the help that's available, most of it is shameful and pathetic. And I think it's a disgusting indictment of our country that we're in this situation. We have world-class technology ideas. This university, it doesn't get any better. The research and output of this university is world-class. It's right up there. But do we have the world-class managers to go with that? No, we don't. So a lot more effort has to be put into creating those managers that can support the development of novel IP in particular. So I mentioned that about half of businesses or more will fail within 3 years, but in quite a large survey that was done, about 8,500 business owners, it was a really good thing to find that 7 out of 10 owners sought advice, but only 1 out of 10 was satisfied with the advice they got from government sources. Well, you know, people should be throwing themselves on their swords with that statistic. It really is not good enough. Now, the internet, Google, allows you to find a fantastic amount of information. And the BusinessLink website, businesslink.gov.uk, is really very good in terms of the information content. But it's really hard to navigate your way through that, because when you start, you don't know what you don't know. And so you really need to have some help and advice about what sequence to approach things in. I have to say that professional advisors shouldn't really take any comfort from this survey, because of the people polled, only 3 out of 10 were satisfied with the advice they got from professional advisors. So lawyers and accountants, take note. It could have been something to do with the fees. I don't think they asked that question. Nevertheless, I think taking the first steps is something that you should see as an exciting challenge and something I'd encourage you to do, but don't do it lightly. You know, it's easy to get into, but it's very difficult to make it work. And the last thing we want you to lose is your family home. So you really want to do a lot of work at the outset before you start this venture. Remember that learning about enterprise isn't, you know, something that is a God-given thing. It's not like that, the kind of moment, the eureka moment, which is an idea. It's about learning a process, and it is a process. And you can break it down into a series of steps, and you can teach it. And we know that because 3,000 people have worked with us with our programme and they've gone on to be much more successful than national statistics. So simply learning a bit about enterprise is the first step in removing the risk from your business. So coming on this course, for example, is a very good first step. So you can learn about it, but equally learning from the experience of others. Talk to as many people as you can. Attend the networking sessions. Get your ideas onto paper, some questions, and find people who can help you answer it. But you've got to really plan for this journey. And I'm sort of obsessed with planning as a way of removing risk. Because if you don't do that, this is what happens. Now, you may have spotted the Royal Air Force tie, so forgive me if I give you a bit of military history. But this is really something that I think is a very, very, very powerful graphic, and one that I'm very fond of. It was prepared in 1861 by Jean Minard, some time after Napoleon's ill-fated march on Moscow. And what you're really looking at is a map. And over here, the thickness of this band represents the number of people in the contingency that was heading towards Moscow from the border with Poland. Actually, it's about 500,000 souls if you include officers' wives, camp followers, and so forth. So about 500,000 people set off on this journey. And as they head towards Moscow, and this is like a map, the thickness of the band along the route represents the number of people who were in the party. So he gets to Moscow, 100,000 people left. I won't bore you with the details of not his finest hour, let's say. Turns around, comes back, and struggles back into the across the border into Poland with just 10,000 people. So, were there a lot of skirmishes on the way? Was a lot of military activity? Were they all killed? Well, yes, there were, but that wasn't the reason most of them died. Did they run away? No, they didn't run away. So what happened to these people? Well, actually, they're dead, as many of you will probably know, because of the cold weather. Now, you know, Moscow, winter, not rocket science here. You could have figured this one out. So planning is critical if you want to think about this. And planning isn't something that, you know, you should be frightened of, preparing a business plan. Planning is pretty straightforward. I'll tell you one thing. If this campaign had been led by my mother, there'd been a very different outcome. Okay? Everybody would have worn a vest, a jumper, etc., etc. Okay, I appreciate you haven't met my mother. Think Eleanor Roosevelt on a bad day. Now, joking apart, she would have asked questions. You know, she would have done the research. She'd have found out about this. So today, she phoned me and she said, "I heard it's going to be cold tonight, darling. Are you wearing a vest?" I'm 54. Nevertheless, she would have asked the questions. And so she'd have figured out what she needed to think about. And then she'd have made a list, okay, planning. Now, for her, it's a bit of a cereal packet cut out on the back, because she's very green and uses things again and again, turned round, and she writes on this list things she has to do, and she puts it on the fridge with a fridge magnet. And so she's actually identified the things she has to do, and she's put them in an order. So there's a sort of, you know, the temporal domain is already there, and possibly a priority things. She'll put an asterisk against things that are very important. It's no different to business planning. You can do this. Everybody can do this. But importantly, she would have explained to everybody on the way to Moscow why they were wearing the warm clothing, because it's going to be blinking cold. Okay? So she would have explained that very clearly. And again, as a really good CEO or general, she would have actually had the welfare of those that she was leading in mind when she was asking the questions and coming up with the plan, which is why I don't get too fed up when she asks me, "Am I wearing a vest?" But joking apart, this is business planning. It is not more complicated than that. And if you actually attach all of this to a budget, and for somebody who is 80 on old age pension, budgets are important, she also builds financial planning into all of that. So she could write a business plan and she could actually come up with a budget. So why is it that 90-odd percent of business owners don't do that when they start a business? Because it's the first thing to help you take out the risk. Now, if you're new to this and you're part of this university, then you're quite fortunate because you have ISIS Innovation here, and it's a group that will help you commercialise intellectual property that you may have developed as part of your employment at the university. They'll help with all sorts of things, such as finding patents, reviewing market opportunities, helping you with a strategy, and they'll help you no matter how involved you want to be. You may not wish to actually get involved with the company. You may perhaps pitch up for meetings once a month just to help guide them, but you may not necessarily want to be actively involved, and they can help you with all of that. And they have really good links with finance, particularly business angel networks. These are high net worth individuals who invest in startup companies. So we're not talking about Dragon's Den here. That's a game show and that's not real life. So I am deliberately rude about that because I think it pokes fun and tries to send up to some extent people with good ideas, inventors, and that's not fair. And so, you know, this idea about where they ask for, you know, investment and they say, well, we'd like to raise £150,000 for 30% of the company. And one of the dragons says, well, you know, actually, I'm prepared to invest £50,000 for 75% of the company. You know, I think that's when Mr. Baseball Bat needs to visit NECAP. You know, that's not how it works. You know, if you go home tonight, say, and you call in fish and chip shop, and you say, I'll have haddock, fish and mushy peas, my particular favourite, and the person says £6.72, and you say, you know what, I was thinking more £4.70. Yeah, that's not how it works. And so selling shares, selling a share of your company is the same. So you've got to actually be clear about this process, how it works in real life. And you can, through ISIS Innovation, attend various presentations that people make where they're pitching for investment. Or you can attend the VentureFest conference that we started about the same time as this innovative idea started, and that's run once a year. So you go and watch how these things work in real life, and it's not at all how you may think. And they're called business angels for a reason, and they're not called business dragons, they're called business angels. Why wouldn't they want to be nice to you and help you turn their investment into a lot more cash? So they're not going to be there to be dragons, they are going to be there to be angels. Now, Oxford in itself, when I started here doing this, was good, but it's changed immeasurably since 1998. And you've now got a lot of professional advisors in the area, for example, accountants, lawyers, corporate advisors, patent attorneys, and so forth. So you have access locally to all the things that you would need to help you make even a high-tech, high-growth business very successful. And that's really important. But there is an active network of private investors run by a number of groups where you can pitch your ideas, and local wealthy individuals will come along with a view to making an investment in ideas that they like. And so it's a really good place to start a business. And there are also links through to venture capital. Now, VC is not the same thing as the private high net worth individual. Venture capital companies are professional organisations. You can distinguish them because they have a dorsal fin. So it's a good way of telling the sharks. It's a good way of telling, for the non-zoologists here, who is somebody you can work with. You do not work with venture capital people at the outset because they're going to eat you alive. But you can work with business angels happily at the outset. And there's some way of a halfway house with venture capital trusts, which are big pots of cash managed professionally, but they have a strong input from the private individual. So they are a little bit more sympathetic and helpful. And there's a very good one in this area called run by Lucius Carey, who I see in the brochure provides a quote. But Lucius has invested in many companies spun out from this university. So you've got ISIS Innovation, and you've got the location and the infrastructure, so it's definitely a good place to start. So back to your idea then. First of all, what are you going to sell? Okay? And will anybody want to buy it? You've got to do your market research here and be clear about this. And it's got to be objective, independent, and really think very hard about who will buy your product, how they will buy it, what they might be prepared to pay. Can you make enough profit on that to make this successful and valuable? Because it's one thing to sort of make a number of products. It's completely different to make millions of them and keep doing the same thing. So really important for you to do your market research. I paint watercolours about once a year, And my mother says, oh, they're beautiful, darling. I'm sure if you sold them, they'd sell for £1,000 each. This is not the most objective bit of market research. And I wouldn't change career on the basis of that. So moral of that point is beware of friends and family. You need to talk to the nastiest person you can think of and see if they think it's a good idea, not your best friend. So you've really got to do your work to remove the risk. But then, of course, you've got to think about the resources very carefully, and that's very much about the business plan, and that will be covered in more detail at the end of this series of lectures. But you've got to be very clear about the money that you need to raise. And you don't need to raise all the money in a textbook fashion. You don't need to raise all the money for 3 years up front. Why would you raise 3 years' money at today's company valuation, where your share price is down here? So, for example, the first spin-out we did from this university, we raised £200,000 at £6 a share, and then 3 months later, £500,000 at £9 a share, and then 9 months after that, we raised £1 million at £12 a share, and then a year after that, £10 million at £40 a share. So you can do this in stages, and so you've got to think about funding strategy as opposed to how much money do I need, and you don't need all that money up front. Okay? Big thing in business is not running out of cash, but that doesn't equate to having all the cash you need for the next 3 years in the bank. So be just very, very careful about that. But the thing to be really careful about is understanding whether your idea is protected. Now, I know that you'll go through this on another evening in more detail, but of the common forms of protection that you'll be familiar with, perhaps the obvious one is patents. But this isn't about keeping anything secret at all. This is quite the reverse. It's about putting your invention, your knowledge, into the public domain. But the deal is in that territory where you're granted a patent, so long as you publish that information, they'll give you exclusivity to commercialise it for a period of time, in this case 20 years. So it's a way of encouraging people to put secrets into the public domain, you could argue, because you've got that protection. Copyright arises automatically. So my words that I'm speaking, if you're writing them down, you've got copyright over that page on your notebook, even though you may be writing down what I'm saying word for word. So copyright arises automatically. But really important to recognise that, very important with software. Registered designs are more about the look and feel of something, whether it's the Coke, shape of a Coke bottle, or the shape of a sort of Jif container for lemon juice. Registered trademarks, very important. I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's always intrigued me that McDonald's put Big Mac TM. This is not a nutritional recommendation, it's just a point about IP, okay? And after Big Mac TM, you think, well, what have they paid to actually register that TM? Well, the answer is nothing, because it's only the R in a circle that's the registered trademark. So one trick to think about when you write a plan and put a proposal in front of investors and bankers in particular is to think of a name for your product or service. I don't care what you call it. Call it Kevin if you want, but put TM after Kevin. It impresses the hell out of bankers. They think you've already got that protected. They don't know it's free to do that. So there are some tricks of the trade, and it's critical to recognise that when you're working with financiers, you do not have to have everything protected at the outset. One of the reasons for raising finance might be to pay for your protection strategy. You've got to understand how to protect and why you're protecting things, but not necessarily have everything protected all in one go. And then confidential information, know-how, is probably one of the most important things that academics have. It's pretty obvious how you might recognise that that could be sold on a consulting basis to a large company. You may be prepared to pay for that. But if by divulging information into the public domain in that consulting exercise, you end up stopping the university filing a patent, then that's a bad thing. So you have to think about how all of this would work, and that's why it's good to talk to colleagues in ISIS Innovation about all of that. And what they're involved with is sort of technology transfer. And this has been a popular concept for the last 10 years in the higher education sector, and I think many university administrators feel they invented it. Of course, that's nonsense. It's been medieval trade guilds have been around for quite a long time, and they were all about protecting intellectual property. My own father was a joiner, and he had an apprenticeship and an indenture, and the indenture is about this big, a sheet of paper, and it was torn in half. And it was basically a deal between my father's father and the master who was going to teach him to be a joiner. And it starts off, incidentally, at the top with, I promise not to divulge my master's secrets. So it's a contract about IP management. It's called an apprenticeship, but it's a contract about IP management. Bullet point number two, incidentally, was if he did divulge it, the master had the right to beat him. I think that employment law has deteriorated since the 1930s. However, know-how and consultancy is what we're talking about with this, and you've got to be very careful about who you tell what and to have a sort of considered approach to that. If you have a single patent from a single idea, that could be terrifically valuable in terms of commercialization, but that may not be adequate to create a company. That may not be appropriate to create a spin-out company. You may be better licensing that to a third party that is already in existence and may already have a global reach for that. So a project we're working on at the moment is with the Department of Health, commercializing some software, some know-how that they've got, with another company that has already got a global marketplace. So the National Health isn't in the business of starting companies to sell software, and so better to license that to another party. Multiple related ideas, however, could well form the basis of a spin-out company. But this is the black belt stuff. This is not to be entered into lightly. It may seem very easy, but it's actually quite complex and difficult. It's actually too easy to raise initial funding. And it's really very difficult to raise the next amount of funding. So you've got to be clear that you can raise all the funding you need to take things through to the end. And so spin-out companies are really quite difficult. I mentioned at the outset that you need to think of a company as a legal entity, so like a human being, and can own property, including intellectual property. So that's the best way to think about it. And you have a number of documents. For example, if I can get this to work, these, which are public documents that are filed at company's house. Now, this concept of limited liability is a deal, really, with the government saying, look, we will give you limited liability. So we're not going to come and take your house if things go wrong. We're going to only have a liability limited by the share capital, for example, within the business. And so in exchange for that limited liability, then we want you to make public certain things about your business. So what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, going what they call the mem and arts, and then you file company accounts every year, the idea being that people can then look at those and decide whether they want to trade with you before they take a decision. And it costs £1 to download annual accounts from company's house. So why wouldn't you want to do that if you're thinking of entering into a relationship with another company? That's really very important. The great thing about spin-out companies is that you can allocate shares. So it's not owned by an individual. It's owned by a number of parties, generally speaking, who have differing numbers of shares in the company or could be the same. It will require at least one director, so that's a legal requirement, but it's typical to have a board of directors, and then somebody would chair that, chairman, chairwoman, whatever, and there's no longer for small companies the need for a company secretary anymore. So that's changed. Now, if you do decide to go down this track and start a company, then you have some quite significant duties as a company director. And if you behave inappropriately, you can go to prison, which is like a bad thing, right? So you don't want to do that. So you need to be aware of what are your responsibilities. First of all, acting good faith in the best interests of the company. So if I buy my company car with my company for, let's say, £20,000, and then I, the next day, sell it to my wife for £5,000, so the company takes a £15,000 loss, I think the other shareholders in my company will be quite cross about that, and that would be me not acting in the best interest of all the shareholders. So you can't do things like that. You can't let personal interest conflict with the company interest. You've got to keep accounts, okay? You really have to keep accounts. And you must not trade insolvently. Now, this thing about trading insolvently means that you have to be in a position to be able to pay the bills when they become due. So, I know what bills my company has to pay at the end of the month. And right now, I do not have the money in the account to pay for that. But I also know that since the Department of Health owes me money from last month, that should come in before those other bills are due. So I'm not trading insolvently. I'm expecting money coming in to pay for that. Equally, I may raise money from investors, and if I raise £1 million and spend it in a year, which is not unusual for a startup bioscience company, what am I going to do in year two? Well, I would have hopefully made progress and therefore have a realistic expectation of raising more money from investors. So again, I'm not trading insolvently. But you need to be aware of how this is operating. You can't tell as a director unless you see the accounts on a month-by-month basis. As a director, you can't say, I didn't know that. That doesn't count. Okay? You've got to know. You've got to make it your business. You have to see the monthly accounts. So you must keep accounts. But that doesn't mean you have to become an accountant. And for example, if you do start a business, for goodness sake, don't get into doing payroll. Why would you want to do payroll? It takes forever. I think it's about 28 different deductions that can be made. They change twice a year. It's a complete nightmare. And if you get it wrong, your employees are going to be jolly cross with you. If I tell you that most accounting firms charge less than £6 per month to do payroll for an individual, why would you bother? You know, raise enough money to pay for those services. Buy people in to do the things that you don't need to do, partly because, to be honest, you're not good at it because you don't know about it, but you're much more effective in doing what you are good at. So make sure that in your plan you've allowed for these things. So you do need a bookkeeper and you do need an accountant. Now, some of the risk can be dealt with by insurance, but it can't keep you out of jail if you've done something deliberately naughty. You will have to go and sit on the naughty step. But there's a number of types of insurance now available. Number one, key person. If you set up a spin-out company and there is an inventor who, and she is absolutely key to the success of that business, then you may have key person insurance about that inventor because they'd be very hard to replace. You'd have to spend a lot of money buying in expertise, perhaps. Second, there's something often called D&O insurance, director and officer's liability insurance, to cover you as a director. So if you're asked to be a director on a colleague's company to go along and give good advice and common sense, that's fine, but things may go wrong which you're unaware of, so D&O insurance can help pay for legal fees to sort of protect you and sort that out. And then there's the obvious ones like billing and contents, employees' liability and so forth. But the last place to go and find insurance is from your bank. The bank will sell you their own insurance products, so which may be very good. I'm not saying the banks are bad products at all. You need an independent financial advisor if you go into business. Somebody who can find the right products for you in terms of insurance, in terms of pensions and so on. And they often, when you set up a pension scheme, become pension advisors to your employees, so you don't have to do. And they do that free. It comes out of the commission they make. So you need a range of people, and you've got to be thinking about balancing risk with insurance. Now, I'm going to have to tell you that your new best friend, if you go into business, is going to be the taxman. You'll be speaking to the taxman quite a bit, because you'll have to cover pay-as-you-earn for employees, the PAYE. You'll have to pay VAT, corporation tax, and so forth. But the taxman is really good in this country to people starting up in business. They have a scheme which is called the Enterprise Investment Scheme, EIS, which means that if investors, if you start a company tomorrow, a high-tech company based upon your research at this university, then you'll find that an investor can get a tax break on making an investment in your company through EIS. So in real life, the first question investors always ask me is, does this qualify for EIS, Russ? Because they want the tax break to put that into your company. Equally, when they come to sell your shares, hopefully at a profit, and they make a gain, they get a tax break on that gain. So they get two bites of the cherries. You never hear anybody on Dragon's Den saying, does this qualify for EIS? Yeah, so that's not the real life thing. So EIS, really, really good incentive. But it gets better. There's also something called EMI, this Enterprise Management Incentive, whereby if your employees have share options in the company, That's really a bit of paper where you say you have the right to buy so many shares at a point in the future at today's price. And at that point in the future, if they buy them and sell them on the same day, they keep the profit. So it's a way of sharing in the success of a company. And they get a tax break on that. But you have to register those things with the Inland Revenue to make that happen. And then, of course, you've got all your personal tax issues. So you need a full range of advisors to help you with all of this. And you may also need some kind of scientific advisory board to help support how you intend developing the technology and turning it into products and services. So how does the cake get cut up then? Well, this is not unusual. You may have 100% of the shares split, say, as 25% to the inventor, 25% to the inventor's employer, in this case the university, because I have to tell you that as employees of the university, whatever IP you create, you don't own. It belongs to your employer. So this is normally how it's shared. And then perhaps you'd release in a funding round 35% or 30% of equity to raise cash, and then you'd reserve 15% to a share option scheme. And because nobody owns more than 50%, this structure would qualify for EIS tax break, and therefore investors would get a tax break if they invest. Now, because you see that nobody's got more than 50%, people will have to work together in order to get things through a majority vote. But in a document called the shareholder agreement, absolutely critical, every company should have one, about 99% of businesses don't, this actually says you agree up front. It's a bit like a prenup. You agree up front how you're going to work together, at what point you can do things like selling shares and so forth. And so it may be that some things, by tradition, I don't know why, it's generally said that you need 90% of agreement to actually change a company name. And so most of those people would all have to agree for that to happen. So you can't have, you know, the inventor sort of throwing their weight around. But it does really cause a problem. And this is about who owns the company. Well, pretty obviously, the inventor says, it's my company, because they're my ideas. I've been slaving away for 20 years on this, paid a pittance by this university, shame on them. I've raised all the money from research councils, I've hired all these people, I've published all the papers, I've even written the patents. It's my company because it's my idea. And then the university says, well, actually, no, it's our company because we made this university the place where you were able to do your research. We've given you this environment, you know, and we as your employer own the IP. And then the investors say, well, you're just mad academics. What do you know? This money I'm putting into this, I've made through my business activities. The taxman had family wealth generations ago. I've won this money through a lot of hard work. Without me, you mad academics would be going nowhere. So this is my company. And then the management team comes along and says, yeah, well, that's as maybe, but you know, you've got the ideas, you've got the cash, but without us, you're not going to go from where you are now to getting products on the market. And you end up with people sort of four points of a compass, often pulling in different directions. If you've ever wondered why it's been traditional in Britain to have dark panelled wood in boardrooms, it's because it doesn't stain with blood very easily. Anyway, it can be very fraught. So we're back to getting everybody to agree at the outset. So you've got to take account of the needs of the inventor and all the various parties. You've got to capture everything in a document that people can agree to. It's the business plan. So the business plan is central to all of this, and you've got to do it against a budget that's agreed. So once you've raised that money, you don't have to go back to people around the board, shareholders, investors, saying, do you mind if I spend the next pound? They've already agreed to a plan. They've already agreed to a spending plan. And within that, there should be a number of milestones to show that you're making progress along the objectives that you've set. So the business plan and the cash flow forecast, absolutely critical. At startup, profit and loss, balance sheets, you don't need those. It's the cash flow. How much are you going to spend over a period of time? So what is this business plan? Well, you'll get a lot more detail at the end of this course, but I don't think it's a PhD thesis. Probably no more than 30 pages. And absolutely just one page for the executive summary. Not five-page executive summaries. That's a small business plan. The executive summary is the written version of your elevator pitch. You have to get everything across in one page, about 400 words. I write a page for The Independent on small business, and I have to do a case study of 400 words for my editor. not 399 or 401, 400 words. And I think I can do that because I've got used to writing executive summaries, which are about 400 words, and actually telling a story. So it's got to be a narrative flow to this. I'm not a big fan of having tables and bullet points. You've got to pitch a story here and get them on your side. Taking investment in particular is quite an intimate thing. The first investment check I took for a company from this university was for £100,000, and the investor came to my home on a Sunday morning before breakfast, unannounced. I was in my attic room, which is not quite as bad as it sounds. It's got a carpet. And I was at my desk, and he came up unannounced and said, "I've got this check for you." And he looked me in the eye and he said, "You're going to spend this wisely, aren't you?" Sort of translation, "I know where you live." You know, so it's a kind of intimate relationship you're entering into. Not the same with the bank. They couldn't care less if you're going to be millionaires. They only care, can you make the repayments over a period of time? It's a very different thing. Now, why are business plans so boring? Most. There seems to be, you know, an emphasis on making business plans boring. That's changing, thank goodness. You know, look at these two documents. The one on the left. Okay, I've got four sons, so I'm interested in young chaps like that. Dyslexia, medical thing, so I have a medical background, I'm interested in that. It looks kind of neat. You know, I'd probably want to pick that up and read it. Look at the one here, okay? Business plan has a typo, and it's out of date. That was from a real business plan. Admittedly, I got that in 2010, but it was still out of date in 2010. Now, a friend of mine is an investment analyst in the city, and I said to her, "How do you decide between the business plans that you get as to what you invest in?" Because about 98% of things that, you know, go forward for investment don't get it. "So what is it you look at?" She said, "Well, you know, Russ, I look at the ones that look good." "I look at the ones that look good." I said, "What do you mean, look good?" She said, "You know, colour, pictures." And I said, "Well, for goodness sake, you know, you could be throwing away fantastic opportunities." And then the killer reply from her was, "Yes, Russ, but I'll get 50 more tomorrow." So you've got to actually get past the hurdle of at least being read. And so why it is that people don't put a bit more effort into that, I mean, spell check, for heaven's sake. You know, it's not rocket science these days to make this readable and remove many of the errors. Now, one of the biggest challenges is about company valuation at the beginning when you're setting a share price. And it is very difficult to actually argue a share price. And as I mentioned before, you have to set a share price and stick to it. There are different views here, but my view is that you don't negotiate share price. It's about setting a price and sticking to it, particularly in the early stage business angel rounds where you may have to talk to a lot of people to find. You have to kiss a lot of frogs to find the prince. And you've got to actually be prepared for some people to turn you down. They just may not be interested in your idea. Or they may not be persuaded that you are the people to do it. But you will find some people who are. But you've got to justify a position of the valuation of the business. And a spin-out at the moment in the current climate might have a hard time justifying a valuation above a million, no matter how good the evidence is. And therefore, if you were to release 30% equity, you couldn't raise more than 300,000, being 30% of a million. So if you are in a high-tech, high-growth sector that requires a lot of cash, then, to be honest, 300,000 is not going to go very far. So that defines the need for multiple rounds, back to the business plan with milestones. If you hit those milestones, you must be worth more. Share price goes up, raise more money, and so forth. So really important to understand that. Where can you get finance from? Well, there's a good scheme in terms of debt, which means that high street banks will lend you the money if it's a good idea, and if you meet all of their terms, even if you don't have the security to put up against it. And they are very, very risk-averse in banks. I know that sounds an odd thing to say, but in terms of small business, new business, they're very risk-averse. So really important to look at this scheme, because the government will underwrite 75% of this if you don't have the security to underwrite it. Gone are the days when you have to give them your firstborn child. You know, it's not quite as bad as that. I have four sons, which gives me some flexibility over borrowing. But nevertheless, you know, it's pretty tough. So this is a good scheme and something to be aware of. But business angels are the ones most likely to invest cash in a startup, high-tech, high-growth opportunity from a university. And there's lots of links with this university, which is good. So they want to know, first of all, are these just mad scientists? looking for a grant to keep doing more research? Or actually, is there a strong commercial application? Is the IP protected? But most importantly, is the management team capable of delivering? That's the key question they want to know. So if you're an inventor or you have a great idea, get yourself somebody who is a world-class manager to help you. How do you find them? Well, sometimes researchers are good managers, and I wouldn't say that it's a golden rule that they're not, but not always, because that's not their training or experience. So because you want to get a world-class manager, and investors only invest in concepts with a good management team, you may not have the money at the outset to get that person in, to attract them. And so there's a bit of a challenge here. So in terms of this challenge, it's a bit like a catch-22. You've got to actually think of a clever way around this. You can't get a good manager in without the cash, and you can't get the cash without a good manager. So there's a number of ways you could perhaps do this. Hire somebody who's not very good. Yeah? Hire somebody who's cheaper. You know, I don't think that's a good idea, because I'm not bought into this concept of needing somebody 9 to 5, 5 days a week, no matter what the job is. You don't need to do that. So the clever way, perhaps, is to bring somebody in, offer them a lower salary, but bind them into the company by giving them some shares and share options, and that's certainly something I would always do. But then think at the outset about an interim manager, somebody who's done this before, maybe for 3 days a week. Far better to have them than a mediocre person for 5 days a week. So get rid of this mindset of 5 days a week, 9 to 5. Anybody seen that film, The Matrix? It's a bit like that. It's a kind of illusion, right? You don't need to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week. So possibly then, a strategy could go like this for a high-tech, high-growth spin-out. You could hire an interim as part of a founding team. That individual could lead the early funding rounds, perhaps from business angels, venture capital trusts, raising sort of 300,000, 500,000. And then perhaps they shape the company up and lead a second round, raising 1 or 2 million. And then you've got the money in the bank to hire the heavy-hitting CEO and bring them in to then work with people further down the line, in particular venture capital. Because some people like building ships and some people like sailing them. My dad, I mentioned, was a joiner. I could actually make a small sailing boat out of wood. I could make it, but I couldn't sail it to save my life, and I've no interest. But I really enjoy making them. So some people like that part of it. So you've also got to think about business being that you don't start a company and then stay forever. You know, the idea of starting a company may be a career in itself. You're a company starter, and then you move on. But you retain your shares in that company, and that's another type of pension fund. So multiple finance rounds require you to make progress in the company, and progress is really about hitting milestones that you've set. If you have hit those milestones, then investors will be happy to say, yes, this company is now worth more. So the business plan really is a key document with that cash flow forecast. But it's not cast in stone. It's a living document. Some of the companies I work with, the business plan changes subtly perhaps, sometimes in a major way, every month at board meetings. We've got a new idea, a new opportunity. Something isn't working, so we decide not to put more money into it. So bottom line in all of this is please think carefully. Success can't be guaranteed. Investors are not like on Dragon's Den. They are realistic, helpful individuals who become very much part of your team. But the bottom line, if you do this, is don't run out of cash. Anyway, thanks for your attention and good luck with your business.